For the week of February 5th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 354, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
How are you, Michael? Have you recovered from the big game last night?
Oh my God, it's so exciting. Did I set my DVR and then I didn't fast forward through the game because I heard the score?
Yeah, for me, you know,
I was prepared to watch it because it was a blow, and then it wasn't a blow, and then it was a blowout, and oh my God, so exciting, the first overtime in history. How exciting. Did I watch the ads? Did I watch the halftime show? I didn't.
Okay, so what we're talking about for those outside the country is the Super Bowl, the American Football Championship game, and how many people watched it this year? Is that in yet? Do we know?
It's not a record high, perhaps because there people might have skipped out not knowing that it would become an exciting game again, because for the first half and into the third quarter, it seemed like a blowout. But about 110 million people, probably. It's not going to set a record, but it'll be right up there, of course. Always a ton of people watch the Super Bowl. And it is kind of a worldwide event. Even the Pope put out a message talking about the Super Bowl, saying it should be a symbol of friendship and community and global, you know, everybody sharing a similar event and time and place. It should be a symbol of peace and love.
You got to love the Pope saying, you know, a gladiatorial event should be a symbol of peace and love.
Or as Bill Maher put it, watching millionaires give each other head injuries.
Exactly. I mean, it's a pretty violent sport. New England Patriots versus the Atlanta Falcons. We won't spoil it for those of you who haven't watched, but it was definitely a game for the ages, I think.
You won't spoil it. I'm sorry. You don't get to complain about spoilers on the Super Bowl.
Okay, well, yeah. Patriots coming back from a 25-point deficit in the fourth quarter to win the game in overtime. First overtime ever. It was exciting. If you turned it off, boy, did you miss out.
But they really should have the same rule as college ball. It's silly that both teams don't get to hold the ball in overtime.
I agree with that because it boils down to what is effectively winning the coin toss.
Yeah, and everybody agrees with that. So hopefully they'll change it. But that's what people are talking about at the Super Bowl. What are people going to be talking about on our show today?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll talk about, well, the Super Bowl and which quarterback did that thing that quarterbacks do so well, you know, when they go back into the pocket and, okay, I don't really know what I'm talking about. You know, we're not really going to be talking about the Super Bowl, but we may mention the halftime show, and then we'll stick to what we do best. Discuss the business of Hollywood with insight and hopefully a fresh perspective with the occasional annoying political comment and Michael's usual slap against 3D.
I hate 3D.
Exactly. Speaking of politics, Trump's new FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, wasted no time in rolling back the new proposed rules on set-top boxes and looks about to turn his gaze to net neutrality. During our book filter segment, Michael will stick to one, just one new book he thinks would make a bold movie. That is, if you want to tackle the box office poison of revolutionary times and dissing a founding father. On Inside Baseball, we'll deep dive into an LA Times feature updating the battle lines and streaming music subscriptions. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We pull our information from ComScore. We have a link to them in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Profit and Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the New York Times, the LA Times, you name it. And if we were just focusing on North America, we'd say, hey, it was Super Bowl weekend, kind of a quiet time at the box office. But we're looking at the worldwide box office, and it's still celebrations for the Chinese New Year, still a big time for people to go to the movies in a lot parts of the world. Lot parts? That's good English. But I'm talking Mandarin and Cantonese right now because the number one movie around the world is Kung Fu Yoga. That's the Jackie Chan comedy. It's a Chinese-India co-production, which I did not realize when we talked about it last week. It's about an archaeology professor searching for lost treasure in Tibet. So it's kind of like a funny Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Jackie Chan is still a big star. $51 million over the weekend, $180 million worldwide, now that they've expanded into a few more territories. Right on its heels is Journey to the West, Demon Strike Back. This is a Chinese sequel to the original Journey to the West in this particular franchise. $35 million over the weekend, $200 million worldwide. And number three, another Chinese drama. This one, I think we missed some of the tracking last week because it's jumped up a lot in its totals. It's Duckweed. It's a drama about a father and son Coming to Terms with Each Other, directed by Han Han. It made $30 million over the weekend, and it's at $90 million. So last weekend, we had found it only grossing $18 million, but now suddenly we're up to $90 million. So I don't know what's going on there, but it's in one territory, and that's what ComScore is reporting. At number four, there's a movie that topped North America for the fourth weekend in a row, is it? The fourth weekend? It's Split, the M. Night Shyamalan horror flick or thriller. $30 million over the weekend, $140 million worldwide. And no shocker here, he says, you know what? I'm going to do a sequel. I'll split it in two.
Yeah, well, do you think that M. Night Shyamalan now is saying, you know what? About those script notes you gave me, not going to follow them. I mean, here he went off on his own, paid for the film himself, did it his way.
I don't believe
way.
He's ever been interfered with on script notes as such. He's had pretty strong control over his movies.
No, there was a huge, that's why it doesn't work with Disney anymore.
What movie was that?
I knew you were going to ask that, and I should have, before I brought it up, I should have figured out which
the
one.
The Village, where they said, hey, the ending's dumb?
No, it was after that.
You mean the Last Airbender?
It may have been whichever one Disney did.
The Last Airbender feels, I don't believe that was a Disney film, but that was the one movie that felt it didn't have his stamp. It certainly wasn't his original thing. He was looking to join a property rather than writing and directing it from the go. But I feel like when he's written and directed, he's been in charge, but maybe I'm wrong. At number four, is another horror flick, Rings, the, you know, not much anticipated final entry in that series. $28 million over the weekend, so that's a good start. It's in 36 territories, but it only costs $25 million to make. So they're going to be okay. And who knows, maybe they'll squeeze another one out of that one. And number six is La La Land, the obvious Oscar frontrunner. $27 million over the weekend. $270 million worldwide. That's getting close to Mamma Mia territory in terms of musicals, modern movie musicals. They don't make a lot of money anymore if they're not animated. This one is really proving that wrong.
Okay, so you asked me about the movie that M. Night Shyamalan worked on.
M. Night Shyamalan, no?
Shyamalan, okay. Well,
I mean, am I saying it wrong? I don't know.
Well, it was Lady in the Water, and there are Vanity Fair stories and Variety stories about, you know.
They ruined that beautiful movie that he had.
Yeah, the clashes that he had with Disney executives and how he you know, as a matter of fact, The Man Who Heard Voices, or How M. Night Shyamalan Risked His Career on a Fairy Tale.
Well, most of his movies, he's had very strong control over every element. So I don't think that that's a long-running issue. It just happened to be a bad experience on that one film. But he made Split for his own dime, $10 million out of his own pocket. It's paid off tremendously. At number seven is Resident Evil, the final chapter, or so they promise. $21 million over the weekend, $117 million worldwide. A potential addition to the XXX franchise, the return of Xander Cage. Will it keep the franchise going? $16 million over the weekend, $150 million worldwide. They're going to need quite a bit more coin in order to make that happen. And number nine is Sing, the animated sort of American Idol movie, $16 million over the weekend, and that's just under $500 million worldwide. It'll certainly get there by next weekend. And number 10, another Oscar hopeful, certainly in the supporting actress category, it's Hidden Figures, $14 million over the weekend, $130 million worldwide. And now there's A Dog's Purpose. The studio and the American Humane Society did a rush sort of independent investigation, and they said a couple things about the video that came out. They claim it was doctored and edited to make it look worse than it was. They found that there was no inhumane treatment of the dog that was, you know, seen in the film, and that the video was misleading, and that the dog got a little wetter than it should have, but in general it was not treated cruelly, and they have cleared themselves as much as they can clear themselves with an independent investigation they make happen. But they are fighting back and claiming that that video that people saw was edited in order to make it look as if it was worse than it was. And we know that video included pictures of a digital dog. So when you saw the dog in danger in the water, some of that was a digital dog. So I'm not defending them or fighting for them, but be good to see the raw, unedited footage of the video, see what was done to it to manipulate it and make it look worse than it was. That's the sort of thing I think they should do. But they have sort of fought back and said, no, we were not cruel to this dog. Small mistakes were made, but nothing that endangered the dog's life or anything like that. That's not the sort of stuff you want to talk about when you're trying to promote a family-friendly movie, is it?
No, not at all. And what I would say is I don't think that the footage that they that TMZ, the website that published the video.
Well, it was PETA. It was PETA, wasn't it?
No, it's TMZ actually published it originally.
No, I know, but PETA made it available to them.
Oh, that very well might be true.
Yeah. PETA handed it over. It wasn't, you know, yeah. Uh-huh.
That said, it was edited to, and at the time, everybody mentioned, well, it looks like this dog is in danger, but it's been edited to kind of, you know, where's the missing footage in there? Number one. Number two, the digital dog was not in that footage, but was in the movie itself, because one of the things that PETA and everybody claimed was, look, you're throwing dogs into raging rivers. And they said, no, we're throwing digital dogs into raging rivers, because that dog
was digital rivers.
Yeah, exactly. That dog was never there.
Well, that movie made $14 million over the weekend, and it's at $42 million worldwide. Back to Asia, where another film is turning up some coin. It's Buddies in India, $12 million over the weekend, and just about $100 million worldwide. That's where it's making most of its money, but it is here in North America as well, as are most of the other big movies that we talked about. They don't want to make the people here in the U.S. who love Jackie Chan or who speak Mandarin and want to see these movies have to wait, and they're not. At number 13 is yet another Chinese film. It's Boonie Bear's Entangled Worlds, the fourth in an animated series. $12 million over the weekend, $53 million worldwide. And number 14 is Moana, just passing the $550 million mark worldwide. And number 15 is Confidential Assignment, a Korean movie that we've talked about before. $8 million over the weekend, $35 million worldwide. Have you seen this movie yet, Sperling?
I have seen this movie, and I can tell you, we have no figures for the U.S. here, and it opened last week.
Well, $34,000 it's made in the U.S.
Okay.
That's according to ComScore.
Okay, because, yeah, that should be, you know, there's no figures for this week, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
And there should be. Those figures will probably come in over the week. But as you say, it's $34,000 last week. It's probably not going to be much higher this week. And it's a solid film. I mean, it's kind of like a figure like Lethal Weapon in a way. You know, two guys, one of them is a little older, and he's from South Korea, and he's a detective from South Korea who's a little bit family friendly and, you know, kind of not the best detective, let's say. And then you have the, you know, crack detective from North Korea who's coming down to, you know, do some covert mission, and they have to team up. And it was, I have to say, it felt like a buddy action film from the 1980s, a Hollywood buddy action film from the 1980s, all practical stunts being done. There was very little CGI.
But having it be North Korea and South Korea makes it kind of interesting.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I mean, it was fun.
All right. Well, you know, I mean, it may have just dropped off the charts. I mean, the number 46 film looking at Box Office Mojo grossed $6,000 last week. So, you know, maybe it just fell out of the theaters. Maybe it just didn't have an audience.
What I will say is I'd love to see more with Hyun Bin, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correct. He played the North Korean detective. He was very good in the film.
Well, right below that is an Oscar hopeful, at least in some tech categories. It's Lion. It grossed $8 million over the weekend, and it's at $53 million worldwide. Then back to some more Asian films. A Chinese action comedy called Northeast Past, Po Ma Zhang Fei, $8.4 million on its opening weekend. And right below that is a French comedy. It's also about mismatched cops. One of them's a woman. Imagine that. It's written, directed, and starring Danny Boone. And it's called Ray Dingu. And it made $8 million on its opening weekend in one territory. So that's opening weekend in France. I'm sure it's probably the number one film in that country. And off to a pretty good start. You know, we're looking at the worldwide box office. So if we want to talk about North America and what's happening there, we got to go all the way down to number 22 for a flop. And it's The Space Between Us, a sci-fi romance set in the near future where people live on Mars and people live on Earth. And this boy on Mars falls in love with this girl on Earth, and he wants to visit her, and he risks his life to come down to Earth. And it's heartwarming and lovable. But it didn't connect with audiences. It grossed $4.8 million on its opening weekend.
I think that's a pretty good week when you have to go all the way to the number 22 slot to find a film where kind of a disappointing return.
Well, you can go even lower, right? If a movie really flops.
Well, no, what I mean is that there were 21 films where you could say from all over the world, by the way, not just Hollywood films, but 21 films from around the world that are doing well and are making money. That's a healthy industry.
Well, we're including, let's see here. Well, Xander Cage, XXX may not make money. That's the jury is definitely still out on that one. But after that, Dog's Purpose, that'll probably triple its budget. And we don't know some of the Asian comedies and the films, what they cost to make. Moana, by the way, it has a long way to go. I mean, it's only tripling its budget right now. It's only at $550 million. That's not a lot for a Disney film, and certainly not with this pedigree, but it's only in 37 territories. We're assuming it has a lot more money to make and it has some big territories to go, because a movie like that, you would expect to make at least $700, $800 million, and it's not there yet. But yes, everything else down to number 21. Well, another one that's still a big iffy question mark is The Great Wall. I skipped over that. That's at number 20. It grossed $6 million over the weekend. It's at $220 million worldwide. It's coming here in North America in like a week or two, but I think there is zero attention being paid to it. I think people have no idea that it's opening. I don't think it's going to do well, despite starring Matt Damon, who's a really good actor, but I don't think it's going to make good coin here in the U.S., so that movie could be in trouble as well, because it cost $150 million to make, and it needs to make needs to double what it's making right now just to get into profitability.
Well, and it's directed by Zhang Yimou. So, you know, is it his first English language film? I think it is.
It is first film that there is, there's some English language dialogue. I assume there's dialogue in Mandarin as well.
I would, yeah.
And he's been an award winner in the past, of course, and we had some awards handed out over the weekend, which basically will say who won in the categories that will come into play in the Oscars, and that just means those movies have a leg up. So what happened at the DGA?
Well, guess who won at the DGA?
I can't possibly guess.
You can't possibly imagine that Damien Chazelle won for La La Land. Best director.
But there is an asterisk by that, right? Because Lion won Best Debut for Garth Davis.
That's right.
Nobody actually thinks Garth Davis will win the Best Director award at the Oscars, but he did get an award at the DGA.
That's true. Now, then you have an award for Ezra Edelman for O.J. Made in America, won Best Documentary. So here's the catch with this. This film also nominated for an Academy Award. Okay. However, it was kind of made for television, though screened at Sundance and in movie theaters for a qualifying run. The question there is this a movie? There's been a lot of debate. The question there is it debate between voters, or is it just debate amongst the media and voters could care less? They think it's a film.
Well, it keeps winning awards. They just think it's good. And I think the distinction between streaming and network and cable and basic cable and movie studios, and it's that those ideas have collapsed. They went and saw it. It's eligible. They loved it. It's a great work. I think it should deserve to win. And who won at the American Society of Cinematographers?
Well, Lion won Best Cinematography. And I meant to look into whether any of the other cinematographers up for this award, both at the Oscars and here at the ASC, had actually won before, because sometimes what will happen is there'll be two films or three films, all of which could easily win and everybody would be happy. However, the cinematographers on two of the films or one of the films has already won a number of awards in previous years, so they just kind of skip over that person and start awarding somebody who has never won before.
I wonder, speaking of going back to the DGA, why don't they recognize animated films? They don't think that counts as directing, I guess, because it's not live action.
I guess. I don't know. That's a good question.
But the Annies happened this weekend, and they are, of course, all about animated movies. And the best winner there was Zootopia, which won 6 awards, I believe, including Best Picture and Best Director. And again, that just means that's a likely front runner come Oscar time.
Yeah, I think at this point, I mean, everybody is loving on Zootopia, so it's going to be very difficult for Kubo and the Two Strings to pull off an upset here.
It's looking that way, but you never know.
Yeah.
However, you do know that if you're streaming Kubo and the Two Strings or streaming Zootopia, if you have that opportunity, will it cost you more? Will it cost you less? Will you do it via your set-top box? What's going on there? Because all the rules are changing at the FCC.
Well, Michael, I know you were looking forward to scrapping your set-top box, or at least being able to buy it and not keep paying $200 a year for the pleasure of paying an inflated cable bill. I know that. Well, unfortunately, Michael, the government has something to say to you, and that is tough. President Trump's new FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, hasn't wasted any time scrapping the set-top proposal that would have both saved consumers billions of dollars and moved TV into the future. He has also scoffed at net neutrality by saying AT&T and Verizon did not violate those rules when making data cap exemptions or zero rating for certain services, thus favoring established players over newcomers, the entire purpose of net neutrality. So that's a double win for major conglomerates and a double loss for consumers and smaller, scrappier firms hoping to compete on equal footing. So
now, is it clear that this is just about big guys versus little guys? Because as the outgoing FCC chairman made clear, he said, look, this, you know, broadband and net neutrality and access to the internet, this doesn't just affect, you know, the four companies that we're talking about that control the internet coming to your home. It affects every company. And if every company would speak up, like GM and people who are working on AI and the Internet of Things, and say, we don't want to have to worry about a broadband provider prioritizing their product over someone else's product because they get an extra fee, and therefore your Internet of Things isn't communicating well because or you have to pay more to do it, it's going to create a big mess down the road. And if every company that was affected would speak up, you'd realize it's not about just some new company that hasn't shown up yet, but it's about affecting business for everybody because the internet is pretty crucial to most things that are going on right now.
Yes, I would agree with you. And, you know, you might recall, Michael, Tom Wheeler was likened to a dingo by John Oliver, the satirist, political satirist on HBO, when this whole net neutrality thing was going on, because it looked like Tom Wheeler, who was the head of the FCC at the time, a person who is in the Hall of Fame both for, you know, being a, you know, in the mobile carriers, so the wireless Hall of Fame, and the cable industry's Hall of Fame. He was a lobbyist for both industries. Then he became head of the FCC, and everybody thought, ugh, this is just going to go so poorly. He actually became a huge net neutrality proponent. And he basically said, during an interview at the Harvard Law School, he said, networks have always been crucial, and broadband networks will define the 21st century. How we connect defines who we are both commercially and culturally. Whether or not those networks are going to be controlled on a gateway basis by essentially four companies is an existential question for American commerce and culture. I am worried about what the future looks like. What is amazing to me is how the commission and seemingly Congress want to do things on behalf of these four companies, things that will have an impact on tens of thousands of other companies and millions of consumers. Those are some pretty harsh words for somebody who just stepped down from the FCC.
I don't know why they're harsh, because he stepped down. The other side took over.
No. Meaning he has a working knowledge of what's going on.
Well, yeah, it's on the opposite side. Yes.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
if he was on the other side stepping down, he'd probably have harsh words for Tom Wheeler coming in and wanting to improve net neutrality.
Yeah, I mean, it's
not bizarre that a guy from one side of the aisle would have a different opinion than the guy on the other side. It's just who's right. And all I know is that, you know, 90 million households now are going to pay how much in a year in their cable set-top box, you know, rental fees? It's like $200 a year. So it's how much in a year does that add up to?
Well, this is according to Mignon Clyburn, who is currently the only Democrat on the FCC. She said consumers pay an average of $200 per year to rent their hashtag set-top box.
Well, that's not
box.
Per figure. That's a widely accepted figure. That's not made up or anything.
Correct.
Yeah.
I'm just pointing out that she's saying.
And there's 90 million households, so 90 times 200.
Grossing video providers more than $20 billion annually. And she asks, is this consumers first?
Well, right, $20 billion annually for something that you shouldn't be having to pay for every single year. It's not even your toy. It's theirs. They get it back at the end.
Correct.
It's for the privilege of being able to pay for cable service. You get to pay for cable service. So that's $20 billion a year is more than the U.S. It's almost double the U.S. box office.
Correct. Yeah. I mean,
that's a lot of money. And now that all that money that might have been spent on something else and gone to something more purposeful or gone to encouraging them to improve on their broadband service so they can compete better and charge more money, it's all lost. Oh, well, that's not the only thing they did about net neutrality, is it?
No, well, this whole thing with zero rating. So this is where a network, let's call it Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, just pick your network, pick your provider, I should say. They are putting in these data caps. They'll say, okay, Michael, you get 250 gigabytes per month to use for your high-speed access, or if you're wireless, you get like, you know, 10 gigabytes per month. And if you go over that, it costs more money or you get slowed down. Well, you're creating a false market. There is no reason to do that, at least not right now. They're claiming there is. But
they really have the capacity and the tubes to do it. They just want to charge you more money.
Correct.
It's not that it would be costing them more money to keep the speed up fast.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
Because that's what we'd understand. Oh, well, it's understandable. We're doing so much more. They can't afford it. Well, actually, it doesn't cost them anything more.
So the thing with Comcast or any one of these companies is they then turn to certain companies. They cut deals where, you know, Netflix, for instance, and I know this is not the company that they've done this with, but let's just use Netflix as an example. They'll cut a deal with Netflix, and Netflix, I guess, pays a little bit of money to Comcast, and all of a sudden they're zero rated, meaning, Michael, if you watch Netflix, all of the data coming in from Netflix to you is not counted against your data cap. So you, as a consumer, are more apt to use services in which the data doesn't count against
you. They make a deal with someone so that one service provider or one thing is valued over another. And let's use a real example. Was it Sprint that just bought Tidal?
Yes, I believe so.
Right. So if you were subscribed to Tidal, the subscription movies music service,
right,
and you use Sprint, they would probably say that's free. It won't go against your data cap. So you're like, great, and you can play Tidal all of them. So if you're choosing between Apple and Spotify and Pandora and Tidal and Amazon Music, you'd say I'm going to use Tidal because then I don't have to worry about my data cap and I can stream all I want.
That is correct.
Right.
Yeah.
So that sounds like a good deal if you have Tidal. Why is it a bad deal? Because everybody else is held backwards. They either got to pay for access, and you shouldn't have to worry about it anyway, right?
That is really the case, is you really shouldn't have to worry about it because you are already paying for the product. You, Michael, have paid Comcast or
a lot of
Spectrum.
Money, $90 a month, $100 a month for my phone bill.
Right, and so you've already paid for the service, and basically what you have is somebody turning to you, the person you've paid, the company you've paid, saying, thank you so much for being a customer and buying our product. Now, we're going to actually kind of hamper that product being delivered to you so that we can charge the supplier of that. I mean, it's just really...
And you know what? I don't do anything on my phone. I don't stream music. I don't watch movies. Maybe once in a while I would watch a trailer or something, but I'm not sitting on my phone watching video and watching music. I'm on Wi-Fi all the time in public. I put it on Wi-Fi when I'm in free Wi-Fi zones. And yet I hit the data cap monthly, regularly. And all I want to do, I would love it, but I can't, is sometimes I need a hotspot. But I can't do it because I burn through my monthly data cap in like an hour.
Right.
And on my hotspot, I'm not downloading movies. I'm not downloading games. I'm just surfing the web and going back and forth between the web and my computer. But that's just not possible. I can't do that because it just blows through my data cap. And then my phone crawls for the rest of the month and I want to cry.
Well, I mean, it's kind of, this is the way I liken it to, you know, they're not, you know, the FCC is saying, no, net neutrality still stands. We're just saying that zero rating is not, you know, breaking
in violation
of net neutrality.
But they're doing other things too. For example, they rolled back the plan to help provide internet for poor rural areas.
Yeah, but that's a different.
The FCC had a rule in place, kind of like the government-funded cell phones. They say, hey, you know what? You need a cell phone in order to be able to get a job, to do anything. We want you to be able to have a phone in your home. And that has switched from the Reagan era, which is where it began, to a cell phone because it's just sort of an essential for modern life. And in the same way, they've said, you know what? Just like, you know, utility, power, and water is pretty essential. We believe internet access is essential, and we want to help make it available to everybody, even in rural, distant areas, poor people. Until the government stepped in, rural communities didn't have electricity. You have to step in and make that happen, or they'll never get it. And that's what they were doing with the internet. But now the new FCC chairman has said, wait, hold on, never mind. That's not happening.
Yeah, I mean, think about it this way. There are communities out there where just getting the internet to them will cost more than the company will make in, you know, 20 years. So basically,
right, that's why the government has to step in.
Yeah, the companies say, we're not doing it. We're not going to go and string a cable all the way out there or string fiber all the way out there. It's the same with electricity, as you pointed out, Michael. It was the same with phone service. And now it's the same with internet service.
So will this be leapfrogged over by companies providing internet service via satellites?
Well, one would think that. However, satellite internet service has been around for a long time. It's just inferior to pretty much everything. Right now, some of these communities only have dial-up access, if they have access at all. And so basically nobody uses the computer because what you have in that case is you have all of these heavy sites. So, you know, a CNN or a Washington Post that, you know, it would take like 5 minutes for the front page of the Washington Post to load on a computer over dial-up these days. So nobody uses the computer at all.
So if you're a tech company or you're in Hollywood and your business is affected by the internet, and I can't imagine how it wouldn't be, and you don't care about the infrastructure, unless you're one of those four telecoms, you pretty much want net neutrality, don't you?
Yes.
Is there anybody out there saying, no, 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 it's better for me if we don't have that?
Well, yes, the telecoms, but other than that...
No, other than those four telecoms.
Maybe the backbone providers, but they might not care as much either. Ultimately, it's the big telcos that really care about this and the cable.
So I'm saying if you're in Hollywood and your business is affected, contact your FCC people. Give them a phone call. Give them an email. Let them know what you think. If everybody who's affected by this actually contacts them, they'll realize people care.
Yeah. I mean, look, zero rating being considered not, breaking net neutrality is kind of like saying, well, robbing a bank is illegal. Embezzling from a bank, totally legal because you didn't do it with a gun. You know, it's like at the end of the day, the result is the same. The bank has money stolen from them. So it's a backdoor way of breaking net neutrality. What I liked was Tom Wheeler's story about going to McKee, Kentucky, a town with 900 people in it, a town specific to this kind of subsidy for rural areas. And he talked about how the town had all of these people who had learned how to code because it was a coal town and there obviously were no more coal mining jobs. And so they basically strung fiber to every home and all of these ex-coal miners were now coding for Apple and a bunch of other companies.
That's an inspiring story. I can't imagine everybody in every rural area would become a coder.
No,
but hey.
No, probably not.
it's cool. Well, it's absolutely true, though, that you need the information. You need to be able to reach the world or you're going to be shut off. But we've got a link in our show notes. If you want to call or email the chairman or any of the commissioners on the FCC, that info is there. You can even call toll free, 1-888-CALL-FCC, 1-888-225-5322.
Well, yeah, you could also call us.
Oh, how could they reach us?
They can reach us by calling 888-567-SAND. That's toll-free, 888-567-7263. You can also email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and up our page should come.
That's right. But don't yell at us about net neutrality. It's not our fault.
It's really not our fault. But I wonder what Tom Wheeler is going to do now that he's got some time on his hands. I wonder, I don't think he'll go back into lobbying, but maybe he'll become an advocate and maybe write a few books.
Oh, he could. And if he did, it might get featured on bookfilter.com.
That's right. It's time for us to check out Book Filter, a book lover's best friend. Michael, what's your pick for the week, the book that you've selected with our listeners in mind?
I'm trying to be more disciplined this week, and so I'm going to pick one book. It's called Never Caught, and it's by Erica Armstrong Dunbar, and it's a history book, and it's a sort of popular history book you read and you go, I can't believe I never heard about this before. Just as he was nearing the end of his presidency, George Washington, back in colonial times, found himself in a really awkward, personally angering situation. One of his slaves had the temerity to run away. And so this book is about Ona Judge. She was an enslaved woman who took the risk of fleeing the home of the most powerful man in the United States and then said she'd rather die than go back to a life under his thumb. Normally, you don't get a lot of information about runaway slaves, but this woman gave two testimonials to abolitionist newspapers at the end of her life, which even then was brave of her because she was still on the run, technically, and she was also putting her family and friends at risk. But she did that, so she got some of her story down. And we also have the letters of George Washington and his wife Martha, who's not so nice. And we put them all together. You get a sense of the world she lived in and who she was and her personality and what was going on. It's a fascinating story. The craziest part of it for me, and I kept stopping in this book and saying, listen to this. But the funniest thing was that they found out where she was, but it was a really politically sensitive thing for him to try and seize her and bring her back home again because it was in states where people had turned against slavery or were turning against slavery, and it would have created an uproar. And George Washington had passed the Fugitive Slave Law, and so there were ways in which you should act if you wanted to reclaim your property, which is how they saw these people that they had enslaved. But he ignored that. He just wanted to break the law and seize her and bring her home and do it as quietly as possible. So he told people to just try and grab her, whatever. But the guy he asked to do it had released his slaves, the people he'd enslaved, and said, he'd let them earn their own freedom and release them, and he'd moved beyond that, and he felt very uncomfortable doing this. And Washington had all these crazy stories about her and why she'd run away. And so he went and talked to her, and he's like, she doesn't seem unhappy. George is like, I'm sure she'll want to come home if you just tell her I won't beat her. He's like, she seems very happy. Then Washington sent a slave catcher to grab her. But again, they tried to talk to her, which was kind of weirdly unusual that they would actually ask her to return. And he's like, well, don't you want to come home? And she's like, no, I don't want to come home. And the slave guy's like, no, but I'm telling you, you should come home. And she's like, I don't want to come home. And he's like, I can't believe she's talking back to me. So it's this really hilarious perspective on he can't understand why she would run away or why she wouldn't return. It's an interesting story. It's pretty gripping, and it would make a fun movie.
Well, I mean, if only because it's not very well known. And let's face it, hey, gee, Mr. President, you know that thing that you just fought an entire war for, freedom? Guess what? Other people like it, too.
Exactly. Speaking of lack of freedom, this week, the number one best-selling book in the country is George Orwell's 1984. Isn't that exciting? Such good news that also on the charts is Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, which is becoming a miniseries on Hulu. And God knows the people of Hulu are probably weeping tears of joy at how timely that adaptation is going to be. But 1984 is so popular, there's been a stage production in London that I'd read about a few years ago, and I wondered why I hadn't come here, but had toured and had critical acclaim. It just never made the leap to the U.S., but now some producers say, you know what, maybe this is the time we should do it. So 1984, the stage adaptation from London, is going to be the first show of the next Broadway season. It will debut in, I think, June of this summer on Broadway. So that's a sign of the times.
So what you're saying here in our book filter segment, a couple things. One, is The Handmaid's Tale worth reading? Should I read that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Margaret Atwood's a great writer. The Blind Assassin is terrific. The Handmaid's Tale. She's a major writer.
Okay. So, and as far as the book Never Caught by Erica Armstrong Dunbar, you're saying that despite 250 years of history, that effectively Washington has always been a little corrupt and people have always tried to go against the president, even those that work for them.
I got confused about what point you were making there, but sure. Not sure what you're saying there, but okay.
Basically, I'm trying to say, you know, here you have the president of the United States. He's like, you know, I know it's the law, but I still want to go against it. Just go catch this.
Oh, that. Yes, absolutely. Just take her.
Don't follow the law.
It was very annoying that she wouldn't come back.
Yeah.
Very annoying.
And now we have that in our current president. So there you go. Nothing's changed. 250 years.
Big deal.
Oh, well, if that's a big deal. Well, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, speaking of politics. The annual White House Correspondents' Dinner takes place in April, but it's already creating a ruckus in the media. First, Samantha Bee announced she would host an alternative event. For those of you outside the country, she was on The Daily Show. She's a political satirist who has her own show now.
And now the word alternative sounds political. But anyway, keep going.
Yes. Now, The New Yorker and Vanity Fair have said they're backing out of the event and or some related parties. Is this the first in a wave of media outlets fleeing the event? Are they making a political statement or trying to avoid making a political statement? Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal, and I think it's long overdue, and it has nothing to do with Trump. I have been for years annoyed, and I think we've commented it sometimes. I hope I have. But I just think it's ridiculous that they do this. I'm sorry, you're the media. You should not be having a dinner and rubbing, ha ha, we're all friends. That's the problem with the media. They shouldn't be rubbing. They all go to the same schools. They're all friends. They don't want to say mean things to each other. People in the White House end up working on CNN and Fox News and MSNBC, and then they go back into it's like that whole revolving door, we're all just buddies thing. I've never liked the fact that they have the correspondence dinner. Like, don't invite the president. Don't all get chummy. It's supposed to be for charity and recognizing journalists. Great. But don't invite politicians and act like you're all chummy and pals together because you're not supposed to be. So if that ends this tradition, I say great. But it has nothing to do with Trump.
Well, and a couple things. For those who aren't familiar with this outside the country, this is the same kind of dinner event where Stephen Colbert said to George W. Bush at the time, you know, he said, look, you know,
it's well, there's a comic who has the difficult task of doing a comedy routine and making fun of the president. Ha ha ha. It's sort of a roast, but they're all chummy and pals. And the president gets up and makes funny remarks. Obama was really good at it, but I still didn't like seeing it. They should not be hanging out and being chummy together. I'm sorry.
Well, and
they don't have to hate each other, but they shouldn't act like, oh, it's all in good fun. We're all just wealthy people.
I understand. I understand. I'm just kind of saying, kind of putting some perspective on this. And that
what's the perspective? It's wrong. They shouldn't do it.
Historical perspective is that, so Obama, you mentioned Obama. In 2011, he chided Donald Trump, who was sitting in the audience for
God, don't mention this again. That's a total ridiculous lie. 30 years ago, he started running for president. He's always wanted to be president. Nobody took him seriously, but it was not because Obama made fun of him. That's ridiculous.
That's not where I was.
He ran for 30 years.
That's not where I was headed with that comment.
Of course it was. You've said it before.
No, that's actually not where I was headed with it. What I was going to point out is in 2011, when that was taking place, okay, something else was happening that very night, in fact. That was the night that the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound happened. And everybody thought, wow, he's like up there telling jokes, cool as a cucumber. And hours later, this raid happens and he knew it was happening all along.
Other things happened in the world while it was going on. Yes, fascinating. But I don't think that resolves any question about the media being chummy with the people they're covering.
Okay, I was trying to point out to international listeners where they may have heard about this event before. That's probably where. That was my point.
I think they hear about it every year because it gets covered worldwide every year. Oh, look, the president makes a funny video, makes a funny joke. A comic makes funny jokes, whatever. I don't think that clarifies what this event is, the fact that there was a raid during one year while it happened.
Well,
that's a pretty obscure fact. I don't think that's going to turn on a light bulb in anybody's mind. The fact is, you're in the media. You should not be chummy and hanging out and rubbing elbows with the people you're covering, period.
You know, speaking of which, you know, I wonder, this is an event that has gotten bigger and bigger every year. Why is it getting bigger?
It makes money. It's on TV. It makes money. It's a ratings draw. Politicians get attention if they do a good stand-up routine. Obama gets good props for being funny. Other presidents get good props for being good humored and taking jokes. You know, now this year it'll be like, who's going to do the job of being comic? Will Trump laugh when he makes fun of him? You know, who cares? They shouldn't be doing it.
Well, if you think this whole White House correspondence dinner is hard, it's very hard for female directors to get their foot in the door in Hollywood. We all know that, especially in feature films. Now here's the bad news. Even when they get their foot in the door, it's liable to stay stuck right there. A new survey says that about 80% of female directors have made just one feature film in the past decade. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, right? Progress is not very steady. Just getting a movie made doesn't mean, okay, now you're a filmmaker, you get to make another one. I wonder what the stat is for men, but I am sure it's hard even for people get lucky enough to make one film to make a second one. But that does not excuse this. It just highlights how difficult it is to get women and people of color into that body of work and get them working on a regular basis. It ain't easy.
No. CBS had planned to spin off its radio division with an initial public offering. Instead, it has unexpectedly merged with Philadelphia-based Entercom. When the deal is complete, it will rank as the second largest radio group in the country behind iHeartMedia. It will boast $1.7 billion in revenue and 244 stations across the entire nation. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I don't know why you would have wanted to get rid of it. Radio is a trapped audience. People are in their cars. They still listen to radio. It's true. They're satellite and they use their phones like I do. But there's a lot of audience out there, a lot of ears, and there's money to be made. So to me, I would rather have built it up rather than spin it off. So I think they'll be happier in the long term.
Disney is the final studio named in an anti-poaching lawsuit to settle with the very animators suing them. The animators were cheated out of wages and other benefits because of an unwritten agreement among the major animation powerhouses like Pixar, Disney, Blue Sky, and so on. It was an anti-poaching agreement. The total amount paid out to the artists who actually make these movies is now $170 million, which will be divided after, you know, lawyer fees, and lawyers have to get paid, so everybody's going to get about $2.50. Big deal or big whoop?
I don't know. Probably a big whoop. Did they save a lot more money than $170 million? If so, this is just the price of doing business. Is this more than they saved and they're actually getting a penalty and they're actually having to pay out of their pocket for what they did? Then that would be a big deal. I have no idea.
Yeah, and I don't think we will ever know whether they saved more.
Do you think there's a sense? Well, yeah, it's very difficult to determine, but do you think there's a sense of, oh, well, they got what they could and now we'll move on and they'll try not to do the same thing too obviously again? Or is there now genuine competition? Do animators feel more valued? We got them running off to Canada and trying to have non-union shops.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I used to actually track that industry and that side of the industry much, much more than I do now. I should actually look into all of the questions you've just asked.
I guess the best way would be to talk to the animators.
Or their lawyers, apparently.
Or their lawyers.
Who will then charge them for talking to us, giving them even less money. Now, the Internet Movie Database just announced it will be shutting down its message boards after 16 years of activity. The vast majority of the IMDb's 250 million unique monthly visitors don't use message boards or the ability to directly contact other users. Toss in the burden of monitoring the message boards for the inevitable trolls and hateful rhetoric directed at films, TV shows, or other uses or users, and they said, you know what, why bother with this? Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop, but I'm not sure. What is your feeling about it?
Big whoop. I'm sure there are, you know, a majority, 90% of the users of IMDb are saying, there are message boards? Where are those?
Right. 98% probably. And every time I saw them, every time you look at movies and there'd be like 4 ratings for like Rogue One or something, you're like, wow, people aren't using this. And you'd see some random comments. And I did start to see more and more just sort of political, weirdly political comments about movies that wouldn't seem to inspire such things. And I was like, well, that's annoying or that's annoying. And I think it was just sort of a backdoor way of people to communicate with each other. And, you know, it doesn't really serve the purpose of IMDb. So it's probably a long overdue step.
For nearly 50 years, the CBS News magazine show 60 Minutes has been an institution. For 40 years, since settling into the Sundays at 7 p.m. time slot, they've ranked in the top 20 virtually every single year, bar one. 3 times they were even ranked number one, and yet, when it was announced that Oprah would be joining them as correspondent this season, you still kind of thought, well, lucky them! Will she goose them back into the top 10? Since they were ranked number 15 last year, that's highly possible, assuming having Oprah back on TV will be the draw one suspects it might. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal for both of them. It's a good platform for her. It's not a huge commitment in terms of she doesn't have to do something every week.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to launch a whole new thing. If she decides she gets interested in something else, she can move on. Nobody will be unhappy. And it's probably a better platform than an occasional primetime special. You know, that sort of random thing that Barbara Walters did where you never know when it was going to air or appear. In this case, it's like Sundays at 7, you might see Oprah.
Last week, we reported on the New York Times dumping a number of bestseller charts that appeared online. It's still unclear why they're being dumped, since the Times will continue to collect data for a number of charts that appear in print and others that appear online only. Is it really that much more work to collect info for comic books and ebooks and mass market paperbacks?
Marsh market.
Yes, marshmallow. The marshmallow market too. Is it really that hard to collect data on marshmallow markets? However, one aspect escaped us. The Romance Writers of America pointed out that romance novels dominate the ebook and mass market categories, and they will lose most of their visibility if those charts disappear. So the charts cut will make graphic novels and comic book compilations disappear entirely from sight, and also make novels written and read predominantly by women. They're going to be also-rans, really. They've petitioned the Times to reconsider. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop because the Times probably won't reconsider, but it does point out a fact that, you know, you're ignoring, oh, these categories don't matter. It's just for women, the majority of our population. You know, so it's, I think they woke us up and made us say, oh, yeah, you know what? Guess who reads those books that you've just cut? Yeah, that's us. So thank you very much.
You know, I have to say, when I saw, I've been looking at the bestseller lists, I'm always like, look at all these romance books that, you know, it's kind of annoying that they get purchased so heavily that, like, decent literature can't get in there.
Well, I think if you have a chart of movies, you shouldn't be saying, why are they listing all these crappy movies? Why is Transformers number one for the week? Well, because that was the movie that grossed the most money. If you have, what I would love to see is a chart, and we can't get it because we don't have access to Amazon's figures, that just shows the best-selling books of the week. I don't care what genre they're in. You know what? I don't care if Harry Potter had four books or three books on the chart at the same time. The New York Times should not have removed children's books from their bestseller list, because that let authors like J.K. Rowling or Philip Pullman and others in the future will never know about The Hunger Games, you know, reach a wider audience. And once you removed young adult and children's books from the list, from that final large list, we said, what are the best-selling books of the week? We're not talking about genre. What are the best-selling books of the week? If it's Nora Roberts, it should be Nora Roberts. If it's J.K. Rowling, it should be J.K. Rowling. You know, the movie chart lists the best movies. Doesn't matter if they're animated or musicals or documentaries or live action, you know, who cares? I want a list of the best grossing movies of the week, and I want a list of the best-selling books, and we haven't had that for years. And what they gave us as a also-ran was, all right, we'll give you these other charts so you can look at your dumb graphic novels. Here's your stupid children's books. And that really keeps them invisible and keeps them from reaching the wide audience they deserve.
Well, okay, so here's a question for you then. Is there room for a competitor to come in and take over the mantle that the New York Times has had for years, which is, you know, they're kind of the paper of record when it comes to these bestseller lists?
Well, not really. I mean, there are other charts out there, of course. There's Publishers Weekly, there's USA Today, which combines hardcover and paperback and ebooks all in one big fat list. They don't worry about what format the book is in. They just say, what's the best-selling book of the week? So there are other competitors out there. We don't have the information from Amazon, but they want to compete. There are out there, but the prestige of the New York Times is not going to go away.
So it's a prestige thing. It's kind of a validation point.
Exactly.
Now, we know what cutting the cord is, but what do you call it when you're cutting Netflix? Is that like OTT cutting, cutting the invisible cord, blocking the stream, damming the stream? I don't know what it is. In any case, it's a thing, naturally. For the past 2 years, the churn rate of OTT services has held steady. And each year, 20% of U.S. broadband households had canceled an OTT service like Netflix or Hulu, or more like CISO. Get it? Because it's
sorry,
a comedy.
CISO.
It's a comedy thing, yeah. Note, that is broadband households, not all households. On the other hand, these are actual cancellations of a paid service, not customers given a free trial who didn't then sign up. Big deal or big whoop.
All right, so people in broadband households are showing that they will buy a service and then get rid of it. So, I mean, that shouldn't be too surprising. Is 20% high or low? I don't have a sense of that. Will that carry over to everyone once broadband becomes broader? I don't see why not. I think it's just a very confusing time. People don't know what channel anything is on. Every time you mention a show, oh, you should watch that show. I'll check to see if it's on Netflix. Is it on Hulu? Is it on demand? It's just a very hard world. And people are switching stuff on and off. I don't think they feel the same, oh my God, I must have HBO. You know, they used to feel that. I don't know what brand has that anymore. It's getting trickier because you never know what you want to watch and where it's going to be.
Well, I guess the only thing to compare it to, Michael, right? I was trying to figure out, okay, well, is 20% good? Is it bad? I don't know. Really, the only thing to compare it to would be cable, right? So instead of OTT, you know, cable is, you know, that's the cord. So that all of those figures seem to be, even though they're muddied a little bit, under 10% per year. So 20% would be pretty high. But again, this is a kind of a new, you know, an emerging technology, an emerging service, an emerging offering. So that means the churn rate is going to be a little higher.
But they're not getting rid of all their OTT. They're just getting rid of a particular service. They're not saying, I don't want OTT. It would be like dropping Showtime.
Right.
You know, it's not the same thing as getting rid of your entire cable access. So I think the fact that it's only 20% maybe is, you know, it's easier to do. You want to dump Hulu, you don't have to do Hulu anymore. You don't want CISO, or you don't want, what was the new one? Flix. What's the new Criterion Collection one?
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Flixster.
You try that for 6 months and you decide to cancel it. That's, you know, that's easier to do, and you're not going to lose access to everything else. So it's more like comparing what the churn rate might be for HBO or Showtime, I think.
Yeah. Okay. So that's more of a fair comparison. I would agree.
I think so. But you know, it's certainly not a surprise.
Yeah. No, not at all. Laws on the books, by the way, Michael, they insist that accommodations must be made for accessibility to people who are physically challenged, handicapped. This came due to the Americans with Disabilities Act, and it applies to restaurants and stores and movie theaters and even Broadway shows. Of course, most shows come and go so quickly that they've folded before anyone can object to them failing to meet these requirements. Indeed, producers say they simply don't want to invest in the cost of ADA compliance until they know a show is going to stick around But hold on. First, that's not the law, okay? So, you know, waiting to... Yeah, it's not the law. And second, offering, say, audio description for the blind is a pittance, only about $5,000. If a show can't afford to pay $5,000 for a pre-recorded description of staged action for blind theatergoers, they also can't afford to open up on Broadway. And the canard about wanting to wait and see is just that. Of the dozens of shows on Broadway, only four currently offer audio descriptions for the blind: Wicked, The Lion King, The Book of Mormon, and Aladdin. Now, a class action lawsuit has been put forward by a blind theatergoer who wants to see Hamilton, but found out he won't be accommodated, despite the show being open on Broadway for a year and a half. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a very big deal. Broadway is the liberal bastion of New York, the liberal bastion of America, and they want to be inclusive and supportive, and they're not doing their job. And it's the law, and it's not that expensive. Now, there's more than just this one accommodation that you have to do. And we've seen more and more people saying, hey, let's have autistic-friendly shows. Let's have shows where audience members don't need to be quiet as much, not because we want them on their cell phones, but because some people aren't necessarily capable of that. So, you know, like Tourette's and other issues. So I think they're getting more aware of what they need to be doing. But hey, this is the law. It's not that expensive. They're kidding themselves if it's a year and a half into the run of Hamilton and they don't have this, and they're missing out on a market. You know, blind people can hear musicals. They love musicals. And, you know, to have a brief description of what's going on stage so they can be there in the room where it happens, watch, listen to the show and enjoy that live performance, you know, you should be encouraging that. So I think it's a good thing. And I know there's more expenses than just this one, but it's the one that they're suing over. And I think it's a good wake up call for Broadway.
You know, I liked how you did that there, Michael. You know, one of the hit songs from that show, the most memorable songs, is In the Room Where It Happens. You know,
yeah, I almost didn't do it as I did. I said, why am I doing that? Everybody says that, but I couldn't stop myself.
Okay, well, you know, actually, okay, so let's take a step back here. This same rule is in place in movie theaters, as we mentioned. And when digital cinema came around, it was a lot easier to include audio description or... you know, for the, you know, HIVI, they call it, hearing impaired, visually impaired, accessibility. It was easier because it used to be that you had to have everything ready when the print was shipped. Okay. And now you could actually ship HIVI material after the print gets shipped because it's all digital. And so just recently, the Department of Justice kind of settled on a ruling, which is the non-discrimination on the basics of, non-discrimination on the basis of disability by public accommodations for movie theaters, which is, you know, captioning, whether you actually have to have captioning or not. It's a lot easier in cinema. And why is that? It's because the movie doesn't stop, right? So there's time code and you can always, you know, the description can match what's on screen no matter what. In theater, the problem is that, you know, an actor may take their time delivering a line or... You know, the timing.
Well, some places do live audio description, and that is an option as well. But most theaters have opted to do the pre-recorded one, or more accurately, most theaters just don't bother. So, you know.
Yes. Well, I guess what I'm saying is it's going to be an ongoing expense, and there has to be. And by the way, this was true in movie theaters too, because you might supply a movie theater with, let's say, $10,000 worth of equipment, and it's never used, okay? So that's what the movie theater industry said. Look, let's kind of do a study, figure out where deaf people are congregating, and that's where we'll send the equipment.
Where they're congregating, they're everywhere.
Well, yeah, they're in some places more than others. So the rule for movie theaters, NATO, the National Association of Theater Owners, helped craft, and they're actually condoning or kind of backing. And that was passed in December. That said...
Just
last year, yeah. So, but it took like 4 or 5 years. It was not easy.
Some people would say it took hundreds of years.
Yeah,
but
well,
anyway.
But so for this, I don't necessarily, I'm not saying it shouldn't be done. I'm saying I don't know how, technologically speaking, they will do it.
Well, they offer it in four theaters. It's possible. It's not difficult. And Broadway shows do not have a lot of leeway, especially in a musical. You are not, authors don't pause and go off and, you know, and flip. You got to be right on the dime. This is a tightly wound machine. This is not something that varies night to night dramatically. And you know what? If there's a show stoppage or something, you pause the audio description. How hard can that be? You know, everything comes to a stop. You send out a signal that pauses it. It's going to their headsets or their earsets. You just pause it. That's not the R. And then when it starts up again, you start it up again.
We should have somebody on the show that can describe all of this for us.
Sure.
So what shows are doing this?
Only, we mentioned them,
oh,
only
Wicked,
four.
The Lion King, The Book of Mormon. Yeah, so they're all, if yeah. you look at these, they're all musicals, which of course are right on, you're right, Michael. They do not, you know, unless there's a real, you know, a set piece drops or something really egregious happens, they're, you know, the conductor is controlling everything. You know, the music is paced and everything is on cue.
And the plays happen on right on the dot too, because there's set movement and everything. These shows, they know right when they start, they tend to stop at the same second every night. You know, they know what's going on.
Yeah, well, and I guess an example of that would be when Mike Pence went to see Hamilton. And
that was after the show was over.
No. Wait, just hear me out here.
Why would I ever start doing that now?
Okay. I was like, okay. Well, there was a one line where in the song, immigrants, they get the job done, or we get the, you know, there was an immigrant, a reference to immigrants. And the crowd burst into spontaneous applause, which kind of caused the show to kind of take a break, a little bit of a longer pause than usual. That would be an issue.
That show has that pause every night.
Now it does, I'm sure.
That line from the day one of the show has gotten a huge round of applause that stops the show. And again, you know, it's part of the whole technical roundup. There's all sorts of technical cues. It doesn't seem that difficult when they're pausing before they move to the next moment to pause everything, including that little digital feed. It's not that hard to pause that along with everything else that you pause until you begin the show again. It's not complicated. Somebody is in charge of that, and they pause everything. They pause the movement of the set. They pause the lighting cues. They pause the sound. And they can also pause the digital audio description. It is not rocket science. It can be easily done. They are prepared to do it right now. They just don't bother.
That's it. We're doing a show on this. That's it. Future show.
All right.
Don't you think it would be interesting?
Sure. By the way, this show is not closed, Kat. I mean, is there something we should be doing that we're not?
I am, as we speak, I am kind of doing everything in sign language for those of
don't
you.
Don't make fun of it.
I'm making
That's
fun of myself.
That's not going to win you any viewers.
I'm
don't
making,
make fun of it.
Okay, well, I guess.
Let's move on to Inside Baseball.
Okay, fine. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, we're talking about an LA Times story about streaming music and how all of these services are kind of duking it out. I mean, we've talked about this in the past, but now Randall Roberts over at the Los Angeles Times has an interesting piece here that kind of talks about all of these services and, you know, their benefits and drawbacks.
Right. Well, next Sunday is the Grammy Awards. And it just so happens, of course, that every year come Grammy time, I try to finish up my list of the best albums of the year, because I've usually had a chance to drive down south and up and back and forth. So that's given me a lot of chance to catch up on music. And one of the best albums of the year is definitely, for me, Chance the Rapper's album Coloring Book. It's on a lot of best of the year list. And that's an album you simply can't buy. It is available only as streaming. And that's the first time that they've had an album of such prominence where that's true. And it just symbolizes the fact that we are in a new era now. And a few weeks ago, we had a story about the Billboard charts. Music sales still provide money to the record labels, vinyl and CD sales, and of course, digital sales. But honestly, they are collapsing. I mean, we have albums topping the charts that have sold 10, 15, 30,000 copies. And that wouldn't get you barely in the top 200. 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So clearly a lot of stuff is moving to streaming, and this article starts to talk about that, don't they?
Yes. Now, okay, let's take a look at just one record company. Okay, Sony Music, they earned $1.2 billion last year from streaming alone. Okay, now, how does that compare? You know, it's I think it's up 30.3%, and that's just in the fourth quarter alone from 2015. Physical sales, okay, so CDs, basically, they earned $1.26 billion. So those are almost even. There's
an extra $20 million.
Yeah. Basically, there's a 1.8% difference. The difference is that that figure in the fourth quarter is down 24.6%. So you have physical sales plummeting, and digital download sales are plummeting even faster. In the fourth quarter, they were down 40%. So you have all of this, I want to own music revenue disappearing.
That's right. And obviously next year, those numbers will be flipped and streaming will count for much more. How much more, we don't know, but physical sales and digital sales will be down and there'll be a clear minority. So most of their money will be generated from streaming.
Yes. I did like in Music Business World, the website, they said this figure for streaming, $1.24 billion, means that Sony's recorded music division earns $124 million every month, $31 million every week, and $4 million every day, and $167,000 every hour from the Spotify's and Apple Music's and titles of the world.
Well, the LA Times had a quote from Nielsen Music. I'm not sure how they come up with this one, but they have a figure for total audience consumption, which I guess is anything that you're listening to, any music that you're listening to. And they found out that about 40% of all the music you listen to comes from streaming music on audio and video platforms, meaning, you know, Spotify, Pandora, Amazon, Apple, and YouTube and things like that. So it's not a majority of the music that you listen to yet, but it's coming up close, and it's practically doubled from what it was, you know, 2 years ago. So in 2014, it was 23%. Now it's 40%. Pretty soon, it's going to be a majority of the music you listen to via streaming services. And the big problem is that all these services are basically the same.
Yeah.
And they all want to say they're not, and they want to prove they're not. But basically, that's what this article is about. These people trying to differentiate themselves, even though 98% of what they offer is the same from one to the other.
Yeah, I mean, unlike Netflix and Amazon Prime and Hulu, where there is differentiation, not only because they're doing original programming, but because the movies that Netflix offers are often not the movies offered by Amazon. They're totally different. Because of licensing deals. Here, what they're saying is, no, you know, one radio station can play Adele, so can the other radio station. Well, Spotify can have Adele. Well, okay, maybe Adele's the wrong artist to use, because she notoriously does not allow herself to be put on Spotify. But, you know, I guess what I'm saying is, ultimately, Spotify, Apple, Tidal, they all have the same music.
Right. And when Netflix has an exclusive, that's seen as something really cool. People, oh, look, I've got to get Netflix so I can get that show. When there's an exclusive on Apple, it pisses me off.
I agree. I mean, I'm
furious. I'm like, I don't care what service I use. I don't want to, like, I'm not going to subscribe to all of you. And I'm annoyed that I can't hear the Kanye album, or I can't hear this album, or I can't hear that album. That just makes me angry.
Yeah, I mean, Frank Ocean basically released an album only on Apple Music. Well, guess what? I didn't hear it because, I have no interest in subscribing to another streaming music service. So I'm already on Spotify. I have playlists on Spotify. Not that I've created myself necessarily, but, mostly I'm subscribed to interesting playlists. I'm not going to change now to Tidal or Google Music or Apple Music or Deezer.
Just for one artist.
That's not going to happen.
Well, Adele, by the way, is now on Spotify. Her new album, 25, is available on Spotify following in the wake of 21. But she waited like 6 months after the album came out before making it available on most of those services. And her album has sold 20 million copies worldwide. Partially because of the audience that she especially appeals to. I mean, she appeals to everyone, obviously. You don't sell 20 million copies and be a niche artist. But, is that the way to go? Where you say, you know, for a while, you can only buy it. It's not going to work for most people, and it's not the game most people are playing. And even Adele, who saw a lot of value in not being on streaming services, is available now on all of them.
You know, for Christmas, I purchased a bunch of country music albums for somebody as, you know, a gift. And I was there when they opened it. They're like, oh, yeah, CDs. That's great.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. What am I going to do with these? it was like,
what country music album did you buy them?
Oh, I completely forget. So thank you for doing that to me. Although I do know it was Miranda Lambert was one of them. The Weight of these Wings.
One of the best albums of the year.
Now you're going to make me go look it up.
Margo Price. It was for your little kids?
No, Margo Price I bought for myself. So,
okay.
I think I also, I know actually I bought the Sturgill Simpson record, which I know you love.
I like it a lot. Yeah.
Hero by Maren Morris, Brandi Clark's album, A Big Day in a Small Town.
You're on the tip of all the hot new country acts.
Honest Life, Courtney Marie Andrews.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
All right.
So yeah, so I will admit I went and looked up like give me some of the big ones, and those were all listed, and I'm like, okay, they're on like 15 lists. I'll buy these.
There you go. Well, and that's what people do. And when they find those albums and those artists and they go to Apple or Spotify or Tidal or Pandora or Amazon, they expect to find them there. It's the opposite of what you expect when you go to Netflix. When you go to Netflix, you used to think you'd find everything. But nowadays, you know, you're going, they expect you to come there for their original stuff. And anything else that's there is just gravy.
Yeah.
And so, what they want to do is say, okay, we want exclusives so that people will come to us because of the great stuff we have. But it angers people every step of the way when it's album exclusives. But other things are okay. They have exclusive playlists. They have shows fronted by artists like Run the Jewels have a show on Apple's Beat One. Pandora has Questlove Supreme. And that's cool. You know, that's okay. That's something fresh and original. You don't feel like you're being cheated out of an album just because Questlove has a radio show on Pandora.
No, then you have to make your decision, right? Then it's, okay, sure. I want Westworld, so I'll subscribe to HBO, or I want Homeland, so I'll subscribe to Showtime. Then you're making your decision.
Well, again, I'm making the distinction between the album that artists have and something like a playlist or a show where they're talking to other artists and doing something original and fresh, as opposed to music. Drake has a show on Apple, but when his album comes out, I want it to be available everywhere. I shouldn't have, if I'm a huge Drake fan and I want to hear his radio show, okay, I might go there. But if I just want to hear the album, I'm going to get angry if it's only available on Apple. So it's kind of a weird thing.
Right.
It's maybe not fair, but that's how people feel. And these guys are trying to differentiate themselves by these ways, by having artist exclusives, which we feel makes most people angry, unless they're just like a 1 week or 2 week exclusive.
Well, which Universal Music, actually, they said, that's it. No more exclusives. We're not doing artist exclusives anymore. They kind of.
Right. Because it's just dumb. It's like saying you'll only be on some radio stations.
Right. So they're
you know, it just doesn't make any sense. But there are big players. There's Apple and Spotify. Weirdly, the LA Times ID'd Spotify, Apple, and Tidal as the big three.
Really? Not Deezer or iHeartRadio or Google Music or.
Well, they listed them as well. But yeah, there's obviously, you know, Google Music, iHeartRadio, Deezer, Amazon, Pandora. Why Tidal would be up there, I can't imagine. But that's an interesting quirk in that story. But one thing that they pointed out that's interesting is the Trojan horse that Amazon has. Not Apple, but Amazon. And that is Echo.
Yeah, don't say the name. Don't say the name.
Oh, that's right. Well, Echo works and computer will work soon. But having that device, there, I didn't say it. Hi, Alexa. Having that device in the home is a great, easy way to play music, and nothing works better than the Amazon Music. So that, for a while, they wouldn't even play Apple and they wouldn't even play the other people. Now I think you can do it. It's a little more straightforward. But that's a really big Trojan horse. Getting that device in everybody's home and having that easy access to Amazon Music makes you more likely to want to stay with the Amazon streaming subscription service. So I think that's even more valuable than a radio show by Drake. You got that puppy. That's really working in their favor, I think.
To give you some sense as to the mind share that Amazon's music service does not have, I haven't mentioned it once during this segment. So, and you know, we're only mentioning it now. So,
did you learn about mind share at a conference or something?
No,
you've used this phrase a couple times today.
Every show I get onto one word and then I just use it again and again and again. I don't know if you've noticed that lately.
How about the word magnifique? Because in France, music has finally had an uptick. After 15 years of decline, France's recorded music market has begun to grow again. Obviously, it's not anywhere near what it was in the old days, but what is powering this final turnaround, a bit of growth? It is subscription services.
Right.
People streaming music. That's just happening all over the world. And if it's happening in your territory, you know, let us know.
Yes, you can do so by writing to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
So compact discs are dead. And unfortunately, so is Oscar winner soundman Richard Portman. I must admit, I didn't know his name when I read it or heard it. I thought, well, I don't really know who that is. And like a lot of people, I probably only have a dim, vague idea of what sound people do. I mean, I do know, kind of, but not as well as I would like. But he's a big player in the world of movies. He won an Oscar for The Deer Hunter. He worked on Star Wars and Carnal Knowledge and Paper Moon and Young Frankenstein, a lot of great movies from the past. And the list goes on. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the classic original with Gene Wilder, Harold and Maude, The Last Detail, Splash, L.A. Story. And when I look at his list of movies, I see him working with a lot of first-time people as well, which I find interesting. And in fact, he became a professor at FSU and he taught Barry Jenkins, who is the director of Moonlight. And he was arguably the first person to mix an entire film by himself. And he worked closely with Robert Altman. And he helped him in creating that distinctive sound mix, which is so, you know, the touchstone for Robert Altman's work, that overlapping dialogue and sound that he has that's in Nashville and California Split and others. Nashville is arguably my favorite Altman film, certainly one of the top two or three. And Richard Portman was a part of that. And it's in his genes, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, when you just to touch on Nashville for a second, that was the first movie to use multi-track recording, where you could have different people talking at the same time. Usually it was, if you really watch, it was one person talks, then the next person talks, then one person talks, then the next person talks. So this was, you know, people talking over one another, which was very difficult to record and then mix later. And that's the reason that they didn't do that. Mixing it would be a nightmare. So the multi-track recording actually took care of that. And that's how that came about with Robert Altman. That's what you're talking about.
And arguably, he should have won the Oscar for that movie.
Yeah, that's true. And much like awards ceremonies these days, often you get the award after you've your big work is not honored.
But like I said, it's in his genes, this, because his dad, Clem Portman, was also a sound man. He worked in Hollywood on King Kong, It's a Wonderful Life, and Citizen Kane, just to name three hugely landmark films.
Well, and Citizen Kane,
they don't get much bigger than those three.
Citizen Kane had big sound, too. I mean, that was, you know, noteworthy for its sound and its visuals.
Yeah.
We're noteworthy for our sound, not necessarily our visuals.
Yes, no, thank God they don't have to look at our visuals, but they do have to look at our links, don't they?
Yes, they do. And before we do, I guess I should say, again, DVR alert, David Wilde, working on the Grammys, Rolling Stone contributing editor, often a guest here on the show. He's doing the BG salute just a couple days later, so set your DVRs. You were talking...
Will he be on the show next week?
I actually should probably reach out to him. He might be a tad busy right now, just a little, doing the Grammys. You know,
well, he always is, but we always get him right after. And he usually has a show like that coming up the day or two after. So we expect him to be here and to speak in a falsetto.
Why? Oh, because of the Bee Gees.
Yeah.
Okay. I see your point there. Well, you know, you can subscribe to our show, Michael, in iTunes, the Google Play Store, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can usually find our podcast. So you should subscribe to the show. And then, you know, next week's show will come to you automatically. And you can find out if David Wilde is able to join us or whether, you know, the Bee Gees have stolen him. Now, you can find all of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Ways to call us, 888-567-7263. Ways to follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or like us on Facebook, just search for Showbiz Sandbox. You can find all of that information, links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's show, on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's netneutralitynow.com.
Which probably is already taken. So if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to thehuffingtonpost.com, or you can go to his own website, michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. And of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.